The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So one of the interesting and very frightening topics is how do two people meet? How do you really meet someone else? What does it mean to encounter someone and really see them, really meet them, and be met by someone else? It's an interesting topic. And how does that relate to meditation practice? Is that in meditation practice, we learn to meet ourselves in such a way that we learn to let go of our inhibitions, our fears, our greed, our attachments, and to be able to be here in a very clear and open way. And then the interesting, it's nice to do it, and some people go off on retreats, meditation retreats, where they can do that in some higher quality way, and it's very meaningful for them, maybe very transformative to them. And then people come back to their regular life, and then maybe they don't really want to look someone in the eye. They turn away, or they meet someone and they want to, you know, their desires are at the forefront of what they want in their relationship, or their fears, or their aversions, or their attachments or preoccupations, or it's all kinds of things that come into play. But what happens when we meet someone else, and we can meet them with the same clarity or the same letting go as we have maybe in meditation or deep meditation? And is it interesting to do that? And in some schools of Buddhism, they don't focus on that. It's not a big deal. What does that have to meeting? I mean, what does other people have to do with your freedom? and other schools of Buddhism give it some emphasis. And in the Zen tradition where I trained, there was a fair amount of emphasis on this, where how do two people meet? And it wasn't just like meeting some, you know, in Zen, it wasn't just a matter of meeting, only a matter of meeting, you know, someone you meet on the street. But what happens when two practitioners meet? What happens when two people who have maybe meditated or have a capacity to let go deeply, what happens when they meet and encounter? And so people can have a number of theories about that, people who haven't. But I think that what's interesting is there's so many different ways of meeting. There's not just one way. And it's interesting to kind of the fluidity to be able to kind of move around and back and forth in all the different ways that two people can encounter each other and meet, see each other. But it's quite something to meet someone else who's dropped their attachments, even temporarily, to drop their fears and their inhibitions, and are able to meet with a kind of real presence of mind, real presence and attention. And so in that regard, it's interesting to think about some of the misunderstandings of the Buddhist teachings on not-self, sometimes erroneously called the teachings of no-self. And when people think that Buddhism says there's no self, then people think that they're supposed to, you know, that they don't count, or they're supposed to disappear, or you're supposed to be really humble if you're Buddhist, or self-effacing, and, you know, always defer to someone else, or accept whatever's going on. And the statue we have here of the Buddha is on my mind a little bit today, because today I was invited to an elementary school to spend 20 minutes introducing Buddhism to the students there. And they asked me to bring the symbols of my faith with me. So I brought our statue with us and held it up for them to see. And I talked about this man who, the Buddha, as a person who is not self-effacing, not humble in unnecessary ways, but also not proud or in the conceited way or arrogant, but upright, sits upright, straight, a certain dignity, a dignified person. And the Buddha is not, you know, the kind of image we have of the Buddha sitting in the statue is not someone who seems to feel like he doesn't count because he's no self, therefore he doesn't count and he can't have any desires or wishes and has to just kind of be a, you know, a lump or Mr. Natural in the desert. But this is a man who's sitting quite upright, chest is quite open and present. And the statues, at least, the eyes are half open. meaning that he both looking both equally inside and seeing what's going on, but also is connected to the world outside, to people, and with his compassion. And so, you know, there's sometimes a misunderstanding, the teaching of not-self as meaning some kind of belittling of self, where you don't really count. And I think that's a misunderstanding. And then there's sometimes people try to explain the teaching of no-self as an antidote to the difficulties that sometimes arise from American individualism. And I think you probably, most of you have heard accounts of how sometimes individualism, excessively done, leads to alienation. Because if it's all about personal autonomy, then there's no connection to anybody else. It's like if you're the only one who speaks a language, then it's no good. Language is about communicating with other people. And so to be too emphasized that I'm an individual, I'm supposed to have my own, everything on my own, live by myself, have my own house, and take care of myself, and done excessively, it can ignore the tremendous interconnectedness which supports our life. We're less autonomous than most people have been in history. And we insist on our autonomy. And then we're independent, make our own choices and find our own way, and me and myself and mine is really big. And, the home is my castle. And then the castle has a moat and guard towers and sentries, and it's difficult to get in there. And so because of this excessive individualism which separates people from each other, and creates a kind of alienation, it's not uncommon for Western Buddhist teachers to describe the not-self teaching in Buddhism as a teaching of there being no separate self. There's no absolute, separate, independent self separate from everything else and everybody else. And I think this is a little bit of an erroneous way of teaching Buddhism. It's a little bit kind of a Hindu flavor, I think, of Buddhism. And some of the people who talk about it are influenced by Hinduism of different kinds, where the idea is to some kind of merger with the divine, and not to hold yourself separate, but merge with that which is most divine, and see that you're not separate from that which is ultimate. But the Buddha didn't teach merger, and he also didn't teach independence or alienation, kind of the third kind of way of being. And there's, when you talk about merger, or the idea you're supposed to discover your non-separateness, some people misunderstand that as being some kind of codependent kind of merger, or kind of giving oneself up in the connection or in the intimacy with someone else. And it can be quite beautiful to give oneself up and merge with someone else. But you can also lose touch with yourself in that way, and lose touch with your own values or what's going on with you and yourself. So if you can be too autonomous, then you're not connected to someone else. But if you give up your autonomy and merge with someone, then you've also lost yourself in some way. So what happens, here we have this Buddha statue here, standing here with the Buddha sitting upright, strong, alert. What happens when a Buddha meets another Buddha? What happens if two people are sitting facing each other that way and meet each other? They're not leaning towards each other, not leaning away, but being balanced, centered, present for each other, and maybe seeing each other. What happens in that encounter? What's it like? So in the Zen tradition, they talk about this as what's called face-to-face meeting, sometimes called face-to-face transmission. And part of what happens in Zen training is that the student and the teacher are supposed to not talk about necessarily the student's problems and neurosis and how do I find a job and my mother doesn't like me. These are all very important issues, of course, not to belittle them. But I don't think when Buddhas sit facing each other, Buddha to Buddha, they ask each other, boy, I have problems with my mom, she's... I just always worried about what she thinks about me, and I can't seem to get a good job, and what should I do? I don't think they do that. Maybe they do. it's not my image of Buddha versus you meeting Buddha. And if you allow me to just digress a little bit, is that okay? there's a footnote, interlude. There's a famous story of the meeting maybe some of you might know the story of Kala Rinpoche, I think it was, a very famous Tibetan teacher. And I think it was Sungsa Nim, a very famous Korean Zen teacher. And they happened to run into each other at the airport. And there was a nice encounter, I think, or maybe it was a conference, I don't know. And in Zen style, you know, they were meeting, these two great, realized people. But they came from very different Buddhist cultures, different kind of understanding of Buddhism and all that. So the Zen master, I guess, was going to challenge the Tibetan master. So he held up an orange and he said, "What is this?" And the Tibetan teacher kind of looked and scratched his head and turned toward the translator and tried to, you know, explain, and finally said, "They don't have oranges in Korea." "They don't have oranges in Korea." So sometimes we miss each other in the meeting. But so part of, you know, the Zen training is also when you meet with a teacher, is to see if you can meet the teacher not exactly like an equal, but to meet a teacher as it having done the ear work, where you have dropped your attachments, ways you're stuck in self-identity, worries, greeds, fears, and just kind of meet with a completely clear and open heart, a really completely clear and open mind, just there with someone. And it's a task of the teacher to be able to meet you there also. And it takes work from the teacher too. And one teacher I had, it was a great person for me to train with like that, and I worked on that and worked on that until I decided, well, I don't think he's capable. And that was never going to happen, really. He's always holding himself as the teacher. And you have to let go of teacher, and you have to let go of student in order to have this kind of meeting. One of the Zen teachers I had, we had this wonderful encounter. I had been away from Zen Center for a while, and I came back. And so he took me for a walk, and he was asking me about my intentions, what was going on for me. And because he was one of my primary teachers, he was wondering, now that I'm back, you know, what was my connection going to be to him? Was I planning to continue practicing with him, training with him, working with him, whatever? It was a nice question. It was nice he was interested. So in the context of that conversation, he asked me what I thought about him. And I said to him that I trusted him completely as a person, but I don't know if I could really agree with his understanding of Buddhism. I don't know if I can really, you know, agree with his dharma. You know, that's a big thing to say, right? You're a Zen master, you know. You know, you're okay, but your dharma. So he stopped in his tracks. He stopped right there on the sidewalk, and he turned towards me. And he was really, you know, and he looked at me, and he went like this, and he said, "Right there is where we'll meet." He put his hands together. "We'll meet right there where we disagree." Wasn't that great? That's where we meet. And so that was an invitation to disagree and to bring that to him and talk about it, but with the idea that there's a meeting there in the difference, meeting there in, you know, places where we didn't agree. And what's that meeting like? Do we have to always agree with someone to meet them? What's it like to really be present and really have an encounter with someone where two people feel like they meet each other in their differences, but also in their sameness? And how often do we allow ourselves to really meet someone else and encounter someone? Or even if they can't meet us, do we stop and really give a chance for that meeting? Do we see any importance in meeting someone in this kind of clear way? I find it interesting that some people are very eager to sit and meditate and be peaceful, let go of their attachments, and maybe be, you know, have some wonderful state. But it doesn't occur to them to do that when they're with other people, those people. But why not? The line between your heart, the line in your heart between meditation and your ordinary life, meditation and the way that you relate to other people, is a rather arbitrary line. There's no real line. It's just, you know, it's all the same in a sense, you know. And so if you're interested in the purity of heart that can come, purity of mind that can come in meditation, I think sooner or later you should be interested in that purity of heart in relationship to other people. And so I said, you know, this idea of no separate self, as a sometimes been an explanation of no self in Buddhism or not self, I think kind of misses an opportunity or misses something there. Because it emphasizes, you know, that we're all connected all the time. But if we're always connected, then perhaps we can't meet. There's no meeting if you're separate. I mean, no, there's no meeting if you're already united. There's meeting if you're different and separate. And there's something very significant that can happen when two people meet each other with some kind of inner strength or capacity where they allow themselves to be different without being self-conscious about their own identity as being different. Does that make some sense? So we're often caught up in our identity, who I am and who I am in relationship to someone else. But what if we let go of that? But still, we're different. And someone else lets go of their self-identity, but they're different. And then the difference is we meet each other. And sometimes we actually see and understand someone better when we see how they're different from us. And sometimes we see someone really well and we see how they're the same from us. And we have the capacity to do both. And is there some way that you only really know yourself when you see someone else as another? If you see someone else as being non-separate from you, can you really meet yourself? So, and what does it mean to meet someone else as another in a respectful, clear, and liberated way? And what's it like to be on your end of that meeting in a clear, liberated way? I think it's a very interesting topic to explore, and it's something like in my training in Buddhism was something I slowly worked at to discover what's this like, how to do this, and what happened, you know, what goes on inside of me that stands in the way of being able to do that, and what do I have to let go of, and until that meeting can happen. What you see in the teachings of the Buddha was he didn't want to define liberation or even oneself from any category of self. And so if, you know, you don't think in terms of self. So for him, there was no idea that there's a self to hold separate. There was a self that was supposed to merge, a self that was supposed to be one with anything, or a self that's supposed to be two with anything. But what happens if you drop all those categories and then meet with someone else? You can't say you merge, and you can't say you're separate, neither different nor the same. So that's the challenge that some people like to take. And in the Zen tradition, they talk about it being Buddha meeting Buddha, Buddha to Buddha, meeting Buddha to Buddha. And they say in Zen sometimes that somehow your liberation, your enlightenment, is not complete until you can do that in the world with other people. And so generally it's done with, so that's one of the places they mostly do it anyway, with in some ways is with Zen teacher, where there's this real meeting. Sometimes it's called mind-to-mind meeting. It's a bit mysterious what that means. But it mostly means that both people are free and they recognize that freedom in each other when they meet. So those are my thoughts for today. I hope none of you now start coming up to me with deep eye stares and looking at me and try to meet me. You know, it has to be kind of natural, you know. You know, it's like, don't try too hard, please. Give you a headache. But what are your thoughts now in reaction, in response? So maybe some of you have a different opinion. You'd like to differ with me and we can meet there. Or some questions or comments or...
I guess what I hear what you're saying, or kind of what I think, is that with me, when I say that we're all connected, maybe we're connected on a lower level, like certainly just as an energy realm, or in nature. But I see that we're all, that would be, I look at things as levels, and I would say that would be the lowest level. And then as a level up would be that we do, there are differences, you know, our height, hair color, and then certain habits and traits that we have and how advanced we are in the Dharma. So I see that we're kind of both. In a way, we're all connected and we're all the same, but then ways we're all separate in how far along we are in the Dharma. But I think it's nice to think that we are all connected in the base. Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. So both connected and separate, depending on what part of our lives we look at. Thank you. Yeah, I'm curious to hear some of your thoughts, your reactions to this, these ideas.
I'm just curious if you were able to continue your relationship with the teacher that you had who made that comment, because I feel like so many relationships, once a conflict like that is established, people decide to, in fact, go their separate ways.
And the one who said, I'll meet you there?
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, no, I started many years of meeting on a regular basis, and we worked very closely together for about 3, 4, 5 years.
Thank you. That was a very interesting and provocative talk. I found it interesting in my life. I don't know how many opportunities I've had to meet Buddha to Buddha, but I found it quite interesting when I'm in that space of being open-hearted and free, meeting somebody who may not be coming from that same place, but the whole tenor of our interaction is different, and certainly better for me. I don't know really how it is for them, but it's certainly better for me to not bring all my garbage, as it were, to the interaction.
Great, thank you. Sometimes I surprise myself that, you know, I'm going shopping in the supermarket or something. I'm caught up in my world and preoccupations or whatever's going on, right? And then I come to the checkout counter, and it occurs to me to not be concerned about the price, and, you know, whatever. I'm concerned about the National Enquirer there. but to lift my head up and really look at the teller, and every once in a while there's a clerk there who meets me, and there's a whole different it's no longer checkout and food and groceries. It's like these are two people meeting here, and there's usually a smile or some acknowledgement of each other's humanity or something, and it's quite beautiful. And to do that, and sometimes it's very simple, an experience like that. I don't know what's going on in the other person, but you know, it's certainly it's very refreshing for me to kind of wake up from my little trance of shopping or whatever I'm preoccupied with. Yes. Oh, yes. Do you want to use the mic, please?
Well, that's very interesting. I don't know if everybody knows that Cosentino's market is closing, and I've gone there for a long, long time, and I know now that they're closing, the food I eat is going to be different. But something I learned there was one reason I'm sad is it's like losing a family.
Yes.
Because I've really interacted with a lot of the people, and, you know, when you harass somebody and they harass you back, but you're both laughing, that kind of stuff. And it's going to be a big part of my life that I'll miss.
Yeah, what a
shame.
And
it's just free. When they see me coming, you know, they'll say something or I'll say something, and it's just open.
Yes.
Yeah. And I don't think it's the same thing. We're not meeting each other with Buddhism, but I know there's a way to contact with people, just with the humor. I mean, my life without laughing, because I'm an old lady now, and you know how you get to be an old lady without humor is...
Great, lovely. So I'm sorry for your loss. I mean, that's like losing family sometimes if you've known them for a long time. And Ruth, and one of the things you might think of doing is before...
Sorry, but I
let's wait.
And I didn't do that.
Okay. Okay. Put it in and I'll talk. So you ready?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry for your loss. It can be quite a loss to lose something as part of your neighborhood and your connection that you've had for a long time.
And don't worry, I've got some plans.
Do you plans? Okay. Good. Good. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let us know how they go. Yes?
I really appreciate those comments but I find it almost easier to meet and see the humanity in perfect strangers than sometimes the people that you know best.
Oh, those relatives.
Exactly. You know, and I have, like, those... And I'm at a funny place in my practice where I start, like, kind of the person said out there, I feel like I'm coming from a very open-minded, open-hearted, and those buttons start getting pushed. And I've just practiced enough so that I can see where they're coming from, but I'm also at this funny place where I judge them for it, you know, where it's like, if you could just let go. But of course... And I totally see what's happening, but I guess I just need to practice more on how to pull. But how do you have any advice for those situations?
Well, I think it's meaningful to remember there's an old cliche that says something like, no one's a saint with their own family. And, you know, so you know, it's really hard in that kind of context. But you might also, if you're close enough to some of the people in the family, to ask them if there are ways that... you can be, if you're with them, to meet when you're upset with them, when you're angry. You know, how can I approach you when I'm angry in a way that works for you? And they say, well, don't criticize me. Just tell me you're angry. And maybe, you know, maybe, for example. And then maybe there's a chance to meet. You know, but if you're criticizing them, then, you know, you're being offensive, and then they have to be defensive. But if you keep it to yourself and say, I'm angry, there's a... and keep it to yourself, then perhaps if they're you know, mature enough around this, they won't get defensive, and then they can somehow meet you in your anger.
I actually do have a tendency to hold back so much that I start choking so that I can't even, I don't get offensive, but I just pull back altogether, so I can't communicate at all. It's like just the wall gets deeper.
You should look for an opportunity of someone that you trust well enough, and ask permission and all that, or someone. Maybe sometimes people do this with therapists. That's the function of therapists. Half the function of therapists is to go and find someone that you can let your anger and frustration out on, and experiment. See what that's like. Rather always holding it in, and if you get let it out a little bit, maybe you'll start by letting it out. You can start then from that point of view and figure out how to change it a little bit until you find out how to do it in a wise way, rather than bottling it up. But if you've never done it before, then you don't have the street smarts to know how to do it wisely. Make some sense? I told someone recently that she had a problem with anger, and I said, "Oh, I'm a good person for you to get angry with. Why did you come here to IMC and get angry with me?" So that, you know, I could offer that to her. I don't know you well enough to know I should offer that to you, but you know, we had a complicated history, so there was maybe some reason for it. But so I see the mic there. Yeah.
Sometimes, if I know I'm about to meet someone, I'll just stop for a moment and do a couple loving kindness phrases. And connect to something larger and sort of gin up this spirit of kindness, and I find recently it's just works really well. It kind of puts a smile on my face, and other people will respond.
Beautiful.
Very positively.
So. Beautiful. Thank you.
I'm curious to hear about more than just the meeting, but the going on. So meeting to me is just like the first meeting.
Oh, the going on.
But then you said like you and your teacher would have different opinions, or if you take a Republican and a Democrat and they meet, but you know this goes on. So as you continue with them, I gather that you're saying you keep this going.
You stay present, yeah.
You stay with the same thing that you started with.
Well, I guess it's kind of vague, but yeah, you stay present. Sometimes you stay present, you engage, you agree to disagree, or you engage and hang in there and talk about what's going on.
So it's more than just meeting. It's basically a whole way of being with someone who you don't agree with.
It can be, yes.
Yeah. All right, thank you.
I remember how surprised I was. In college. I kind of grew up in this kind of liberal household and democratic kind of household and atheist household. And then I was assigned this chemistry lab, this woman to be my chemistry lab partner, and she was a fundamentalist Christian Republican. Like, she was like so out of this world for me. I mean, where do you find people like that? You know, it was so foreign from my world, my little narrow world that I live in, right? And I was so surprised what a beautiful woman she was. And we had this great rapport. And it was such an eye-opening to me that I could have such a close, good relationship with someone who at first I thought that I would, not get along with at all because I thought that we were so different or something and I disagree with so much. And that opened me up a lot to be able to meet people and not see them through these labels that we often see people through.
So far, we've talked about face-to-face meetings. Now, you alluded to the fact that there are a lot of people out there listening worldwide who will never get the opportunity to meet face-to-face here. An interesting insight on that for me was, after listening to many talks but having no idea what the people looked like, you started putting photos up on the web of the various speakers, and I had then realised I'd built preconceptions in my mind about what you all looked like, who you were, and suddenly these pictures popped up. Wasn't anything at all like what I'd imagined and built up in my mind. Now, I've been very fortunate in having business bring me here occasionally to be able to meet people and see the IMC. But there are a lot of meetings go on where you don't see the other person, including oral work and books. Now, from time to time you read a series of books and it's obvious that this person and that person is an eminent person and I really should read them and I should study them, and I do, and I build up my interpretations of them from the word. Sometimes I feel there's a meeting there, and yes, I agree with that, and that's well written, and that's a good book, and sometimes not. Could you just mention the challenges of self-education, where you're not in contact with the people, and quite remote, and some of the ways of addressing the difficulties that can bring? In other words, keeping a steady mind and not putting too many of personal interpretations on the things you're reading and hearing and even seeing on video sometimes.
So yeah, it's I think that's a great topic you're bringing up. It seems like it's a big one to talk about in a few minutes here. But what occurs to me, if I may just kind of pick one point out of it, is that if you are practicing Buddhism or listening to the Dharma online or reading books, and you don't then have a direct connection with the teacher, the writer, the speaker, you don't see them, they don't have that living connection, then that's okay, because then what you do is you practice that living connection to the people that you are in direct touch with. So your neighbors, colleagues, relatives, you kind of practice there and try to find a way to meet them in a more realistic, deeper way, more full way. And and then you won't need to come back to IMC. Though we'd love to see you again. So, everyone, I hope this was more provocative than not. So it gave you something to think about and challenge you, and as you go about with your, you know, those times when you encounter other people. So may those encounters be meaningful for you and everyone. Thank you.